piece, it happens that there's a thread that's woven through the service. And I think the songs that Dahlia picked today, I kept getting like shocked and shocked. Because today I want to talk about love, and I wore a pink shirt by accident, but you know. And it's a huge topic, so narrowing it down was a trick. I hope you don't suffer for that. but also, New Year's resolution more often. Look people in their eyes, write a thought about God's love regularly, and lose weight. You can probably tell which of these may or may not have happened. But they came at New Year's following up on this brilliant idea that I'd had a few months previous to that, when I made a goal to set aside 5 minutes daily to contemplate and receive, ponder, internalize God's love. I was pretty sure it would be a mind-blowing exercise, and that my head and my heart and my life would explode with this internalization of our Creator's love. As you may have predicted, the daily exercise lasted for about 6 days, 2 journal entries, and 1 intensely powerful realization I had while jogging one day. But I wanted to share some thoughts that were triggered by this exercise. As I said, it's an ambitious topic, and I'm sure we'll never run out of material in discussing it. People write, sing, teach, film about love, and they offer us so many ideas about what love does and what it means. Love wins, love waits. All we need is love. I heard of a conference this week called Love Does Stuff. It's a Christian conference. And we as individuals and families and communities and consumers are in an ongoing conversation with each other, an unconscious dialogue with the world about our ways of loving. And I tend to be kind of abstract and and so I thought I would start on a lighter note and offer one of these snippets of what's out there in the world about love. So this is I'll set it up. This is a video from a favorite of mine. He's called Kid President, and he makes really cute videos. And he talks really fast, so I apologize. But he got some friends who are musicians, little kids, and they wrote a love song. So I thought it would be fun to hear it. This passage encapsulates many of my thoughts and reflections. It prompts my exploration and questions that serve as a framework for this today's reflection. How deep is Christ's love? How does God's love dig its roots into me and establish itself? How does it empower me and us as a community? The year that I started my exercise of my short-lived exercise of contemplation, it interestingly began when celebrating Christmas. And we hear so many cliches about looking beyond the Christmas trees and the tinsel to the reason for the season. And I kind of, you know, hear that every year, and I kind of roll my eyes and stand up and sing Silent Night and all of that. But with most cliches, there are truth. And of all the reminders we have, the Advent candles, the readings and the songs, the celebrations that we share, or the emotions that ride high, it can be a real challenge to get a fresh vision of what we are actually celebrating. I was looking through these journal reflections, and I wrote this down on December 25th, 2011. It is hard to get to that place of remembering and reflecting on the impact of the day amidst all the ritual and the scripts and the verses and traditions. But last week, Claire Fawn, she's here, she made it in my journal, talked about Advent and how Emmanuel came to us with all our baggage to affirm that he created us and he loves us, his creation. I don't know why, but sometimes when remembering that celebrating the incarnation is about him becoming human and then dying, I forget that he did it because of his deep, burning desire to be close to us and to right the world that he made. It was perhaps the first time I ever thought about the incarnation being an act of desire. I was reminded by this piece of writing by a songwriter named Linford Detweiler, who I love, who writes beautiful lyrics for his band called Over the Rhine. He talks about Christmas as the darkest night of the year. He writes, "To me, it has always been about secret, impossible plans, this quiet revolution born out of many long conversations around heaven's fireplace. I want to remember that mad agenda of Christ's, to save this whole family we call man. I sit down at the piano and find it impossible to remember Bethlehem without remembering Gethsemane." The writer invokes a kind of cosmic supernatural idea in our imagination, that God is up there around heaven's fireplace, dreaming up ways to be with us, like an impatient lover pacing next to the phone, anticipating how is he going to call his beloved. And the plan that God worked out, the only way he could get to us, was one that involved the sacrifice of his son. He didn't send a message in the stars or paint, "I love you, will you marry me," on the highway wall. He had to inhabit and incarnate his passion. Then his plan necessitated a brutal endgame of sacrifice and pain in the crucifixion and resurrection. We see in Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane how far he's willing to go to pass on this message. He, through real sacrifice, put his own will aside to demonstrate the depths of his love. John 17:22, in his prayer, he says that they may, he's praying, he said that they may be one as we are one, I and them, and you and me, so they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as I have loved, as you have loved me. So that year at Christmas, coming into the realization of God's loving motivation, I took my earthly lens to look at the relationships building that took place there. And the practice of looking at it or framing it in human terms gave me a fresh perspective on the story. God loved us so much that he sent his son. Heard that before. God loved us so much that he sent his son to die. His plot to get close to us and his son, using his son as an instrument in that plot, demonstrated a love that had no boundaries. And if I were to say that about a person, it would not necessarily be a compliment. Many ministers have been criticized for sacrificing time and energy for the ministry at the expense of their family. Many a spouse has been faulted for loving or in such a way that their personal identity is consumed into the needs or the identity of their loved one. If we heard about someone here now who was giving up his child just to demonstrate his love to someone, we would probably call child services. But God is proud of his lack of boundaries. He emphasizes it more than once. He says, "Greater love has no one than this, that he should lay down his life for his friends." That's crazy talk when you are trying to understand love from our earthly perspective. It's not our inclination. And we often discuss human relations in terms of the need for or lack of boundaries. In schools, workplaces, and in families, boundaries are there to create safe environments. Boundaries protect when love is misdirected or malfunctions. And goodness knows we live in a world of misdirected loves. But this is where the metaphor breaks down. God has no need to keep himself safe from us. He came and experienced the world as a human being, vulnerable to pain, temptation, loss, and disappointment. Christ interacted with real people, asking for their devotion, and sometimes experiencing rejection instead. He said, "Peter, do you love me?" And he gave him the option to respond. He gives us the same option, and sometimes we reply with dedicated enthusiasm, "Yes, Lord," and other times with passive neglect. But Paul reminds us in Romans 8 that nothing separates us from the love of God that is in Christ our Lord. None of our responses will change God's desire or ability to cover us with that love. We might be constantly busy with actions of love and trying to do relationships, but God just is love. I'm going to quote a lot from Brennan Manning today. He's a former priest who died recently, and he wrote amazing works that I recommend, and particularly the book that he wrote called The Furious Longing of God is one that I'm drawing on heavily today. But what he said was this: in human beings, love is a highly prized virtue, a quality. In God, it is his identity. He's not one part hope, one part justice, some righteousness, and three parts love. John tells us that he is love. Love is his identity. Because love is his essence and his nature, talking about boundaries in relation to God is irrelevant. You can't rein in or contain identity. And because love is his identity, there's no risk of him becoming something else or burning out. His identity isn't going to wear thin. It is abundant and extravagant. Our limitations, our human models of love, are just poor reflections of his capacities. Manning wrote, The love of the Father for his children plunges us into mystery because it is utterly beyond the pale human experience. The parable of the prodigal son reveals a love that is gratuitous. He continues, Jesus says in the parable, "That's the way my Father is. He wants you home more than you want to be home. His love knows no bounds. Never compare your pallid, capricious, I don't know what that word means, conditional human love with my Father's love. He is God, not man." All of these things kind of came up for me a while ago, many years ago, once when we had a layover in Rome with my family, my parents. It was 12 hours, and I said, "We're going to see Rome," and I dragged them along, and my mom was wearing uncomfortable shoes. But we were winding our way through the small alleys with the scooters and the cafes and just marching through. And I don't remember where you guys were, but I just came, turned a corner, and there was this fountain. And it was flat. It's like a flat basin, probably 3 meters high, like a giant wide chalice. And the water had filled all the way up to the top, so that the surface was flat and reflective. There was no source. The water was spilling gently over the sides of the fountain into the basin below. But the fountain's water level didn't diminish, and there didn't seem to be a source that we could see. And I don't remember why or what was going on in my life at that moment, but I do remember it to be a moment of profound pause, like a revelation, an image. And the light that was kind of golden and gauzy and colored by the walls of the city and the sound and the space all came together, and my breath was just taken away. And I thought, later I was thinking about that, and I thought, that image, that fountain is, for me, that image is God's love. And it fills up. Just a minute. It fills up the basin of my heart with his peace. His love. His love is abundant and unwavering. We can't jump in and splash the water out of it. It does not run dry. And if God's identity is love, then our identity is the loved. We are lovable. This lavish outpouring, the flowing fountain, falls on us because we are lovely. And all the unlovely parts of us are irrelevant. I find we often talk in terms of being loved in spite of ourselves, because we're loved even though we're unworthy. But I think this is held in tension with the fact that we are his creation, and he thought his creation was good. His love affirms our humanity. He cares about the hairs on our head, however many they are, or however gray they are. He thinks they're beautiful. He may even be proud of us, proud that we try, proud that we care, proud that we laugh, proud that we enjoy the creation, proud that we remember him. And I think we often think we have to work so hard to be good enough to love. We feel the need to evaluate our spiritual growth, set goals, work on ourselves. The list of New Year's resolutions I mentioned is one of many in my journal of how I'm going to improve this year. And mainly it's about my own personal and spiritual growth that will get me there. Aiming for perfection is admirable, even biblical, but it can be a trap, a self-made trap, when it is nothing more than egoism or the desire to control everything and leaves no room for God to perfect us. Perfectionism is the opposite of grace. It is grinding, and it inflates our sense of importance. And we can all be guilty of getting stuck in our emotions and thoughts when we're so deep in introspection and awareness of our needs for growth. But this distracts us from our main role. We are his beloved. So when I figure out how to put myself in a place where I am prone to experience the depths of love, grace pushes back. I don't have to work as hard. I might start to see, to like myself a little more and recognize that all those imperfections aren't really that important. In fact, some of them are beautiful. And the spectacular conundrum of God's love is that it both affirm how important we are, how valued we are, and at the same time freeing us of the weight of self-importance. I have a dear friend and colleague who is not a believer, but she said that one day she woke up and realized we just don't matter all that much. And I go, But she said, no, all these things, we're working so hard on all these little things, and it doesn't matter in the big picture. And I think there's that tension there that we matter completely, and yet we don't so much. We matter to Him, no matter what we do or like. And there is nothing that we can do or deserve to do or try to do to matter. We just matter because we're His. We're not a dependent factor in the equation. He doesn't love us because we love Him back. We can learn that in some ways, all the best ways. We are not really that important except that we are loved. And that is so much more than being important. Experiencing this kind of love requires us to see ourselves in a new light. It changes how we look at ourselves and others. And the experience can be so freeing, so life-affirming, so accepting. It's transformational, and it is empowering. I brought a clip by a teacher who is an award-winning, renowned teacher in the U.S. Her name is Rita Pearson. And the way that she talks about working with her students reminds me of God's approach to us. We are like the students she's going to talk about who struggle to perform. And through our relationship with Him, He reinvents who we are. And He's pretty happy. You're trying. You're doing it. He helps us redefine ourselves not as failures or lacking or less than, but as completely worthy. All this is kind of abstract, and even though I've had this exercise, short-lived exercise of meditating on God's love, often I, like probably most of us, struggle to feel it or experience it in a real way. I'm sure that some of us struggle with feelings of abandonment or confusion at times, wondering where is God at a time like this? How could a loving God allow something this terrible to happen? A few days ago, it reminds me of a story. A few days ago, my sister Lindsay told me about her daughter Scarlett, who's 4 years old. Imagine the cutest four-year-old you can, and that's her in the story. She says she's laying on the ground with her feet in the air, just hanging out. Lindsay's doing things around the house. And Scarlett said, Mom, she asks a lot of questions. Mom, does God walk on the ground? No. Does He drive in a car? No, Lindsay says. Does He walk in the clouds? No. Does He walk on the street? No. So where is He? And Lindsay said, He's in your heart. And goes back to her business. Minutes pass, Scarlett's still waving her legs around on the floor. She says, God! God, are you there? If you can imagine, for most of us, we're like Scarlett, trying to connect with God. We don't know where He is. Where are the signs? We don't have Him physically. We want to feel His touch. Because we're physical beings, we know things with our bodies and our senses. Jesus gave us a way of remembering Him by tasting wine and bread as symbols of His body and blood. And churches for centuries have been giving us physical opportunities of devotion, crossing ourselves, kneeling, raising our hands, singing, worshiping. These can be tangible ways to connect. These rituals can be ways of capturing the exchange of love, of receiving it, expressing it. David Pileggi once talked about symbols in a sermon of his. He said, symbols bind up reality. I thought that was so beautiful. I would extend it and say that these actions of devotion can be holders of our emotions. We do have ways to reach out to the One. As Joe mentioned in the parasha today, today we're celebrating Pentecost, where the Holy Spirit reached out to us. But still, sometimes we feel a gap. We have a space to bridge. We have an absence, and we cross it through the gifts of faith and hope that we will someday get to know the fullness of feeling His love. For now, we are asked to know God's touch in the presence of His actual hand. Perhaps His hand would be too real or too heavy or might burn us. We can't look on His face at this point from our limitations. Our intimacy is limited by our nature and identity, but we are given glimpses. And you might sense that I want to turn to 1 Corinthians 13. The guts of this passage, the famous part we know and sometimes read at wedding, tells us what love does, love how it is, it's patient, it's kind. But it's framed by two bookends about the, you could say, inadequacies of our human abilities or gifts. I want to read in the first part. Now I will show you the most excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men and angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but not love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor, surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I am nothing. So he's telling us we can do all these things. He's just been talking, writing to the church about how one body has many parts, how each person plays a role. We have different gifts that we can contribute. And he says we can contribute all these things, but if there's no love behind it, it's not enough. It's insufficient. And he goes on, and he tells us how love behaves. Love is patient. Love is kind, does not envy, does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no records of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but it rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. We can unpack that for the rest of our lives, and I'm going to just skip over it today. But we have in there this beautiful picture of how love acts. And then he goes on and reminds us that our gifts of prophecy and knowledge are slightly less than perfect, and we are children with childish ways. I'll read from verse 8. Love never fails, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection, as in a mirror. And then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. He says that someday we'll get it. We will see face to face, and we will know and be fully known. I used to think that meant that all our questions will be answered. We'll know all the mysteries. Will dogs get to heaven? Does he have a plan? Why is he allowing this or that to happen? We would know stuff when we got there. And he could be saying that. But then he goes and he talks about love remaining. And he says that these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. What do these things have to do with each other, our impartial knowledge and the love that continues? Perhaps he talks about us maturing and seeing face to face and being known. When he's talking about that, he's talking about intimacy and fullness. And we spend a lot of time talking about the world to come and the end times, and they're often discussed in terms of power and authority and victory and fulfillment of prophecy. That is part of it. But Paul offers, to me, another focus. Love is eschatological. It has to do with the end. Paul reminds us that love remains, and we will someday know the fullness of God. And that is when all our failing loves, our feeble attempts, will be perfected. We will meet him and see face to face. I want to read this story that Brennan Manning wrote in his book that I mentioned before, about a woman named Yolanda. Yolanda had leprosy, and before she had leprosy, she says, the most mesmerizing, most translucent brown eyes I've ever seen, set in this exquisitely chiseled face with high cheekbones, long brown hair down to a slender waist, and a perfectly proportioned bust. But that was then. Now her nose was pressed into her face, her mouth was contorted, both ears were distended, she had no fingers on either hand, just two little stumps. One of the first effects of leprosy is losing all sensitivity in your extremities, toes and fingers. A leper can rest her head on a burning hot stove and absolutely feel nothing, which leads to eventual amputation. Yolanda had just these two little stumps for fingers. 2 years earlier, her husband had divorced her, and he, because of the stigma attached to leprosy, he had forbidden her sons who were teenagers to ever visit their mother. He was an alcoholic, so they were afraid of him, and they listened to him and never visited her. Yolanda was dying, an abandoned, forsaken woman. Brennan Manning writes, "I anointed Yolanda with oil and prayed with her. And as I turned around to put the top back on the bottle of the oil, the room was filled with a brilliant light. It had been raining when I came in. I didn't even look up. But I said, 'Thanks, Abba, for the sunshine. I bet that'll cheer her up.' And as I turned to look back at Yolanda, and if I live to be 300 years old, I'll never be able to describe in words what I saw. Her face was like a sunburst over the mountains, like 1,000 sunbeams streaming out of her face, literally, so brilliant I had to shield my eyes. I said, 'Yolanda, you appear to be very happy.' With her slight Mexican-American accent, she said, 'Oh, Father, I'm so happy.' And I asked her, 'Well, tell me why you're happy.' And she said, 'Yes, the Abba of Jesus has just told me that he will take me home today.' I vividly remember the hot tears that began rolling down my cheeks. After a lengthy pause, I asked just what the Abba of Jesus said. And Yolanda said, 'Come now, my love, my lovely one, come. For you, the winter has passed, the snows are over, the flowers appear in the land, the season of joyfulness, joyful songs has come. The cooing of the turtle dove is heard in our land. Come now, my love, Yolanda, come. Let me see your face, and let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is beautiful. Come now, my love, my lovely one, come.'" 6 hours later, in her leprous body was swept up into the furious love of her Abba. But later that day, I learned from the staff that Yolanda was illiterate. She had never read the Bible, or any book for that matter, in her entire life. I surely had never repeated those words to her in any of my visits. I was, as they say, a man undone. I think those verses from Song of Songs, if we can hear them and meditate on them, they might be life-changing. If we can inhabit them, if they can become part of our exploration. Today, this is an incomplete reflection. Most of the texts that are about love go beyond saying you are loved. The Shema says, love your neighbor as yourself. John says, dear friends, since God so loved us, we ought to love one another. And Jesus takes it further and says, love your enemies. And that particular message is particularly poignant, profound in our particular context. I think it deserves a whole other day to explore what it means to externalize the love that I'm talking about internalizing today. Today, concentrated on the God so loved us part. But there's so much to explore about loving one another. I think we'll spend our lives fleshing it out. But I did want to conclude at least by starting the idea. Paul prayed that we would someday come to understand his love, not in isolation, but as he said in the first verse I read, together with all the saints. Tomorrow marks a special day for the saints. As Pentecost, it is a time when we remember Jesus' followers came together and the Holy Spirit encountered them. A time of powerful connection with the Father. In Acts 2:42-47, it almost seems like after that there was a kind of a honeymoon period in Jerusalem. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and prayer. This is from Acts. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. There's a climate where people were sharing everything. Private property became community property. Relationships were strong, and they were glad about it. And it says they were really glad, sincerely glad to be together. They weren't being fake. They weren't being inauthentic or just plain old nice. And then later, as the generations, I'm not an early church historian or anything even near there, but what we have in the letters that I've been reading from today to Corinth and Ephesus are later written to the generations that followed that were influenced by culture and lifestyles and separated by time and geography. It is from those letters that Paul wrote to the believers in Ephesus and Corinth that we read today. And in those letters, the message of love is so salient. It is so strong, powerful. So when we encounter each other in community or even in just proximity, we are constantly challenged to love. I don't mean a touchy-feely, superficial kindness either, or silly love songs, but we are pushed to love in an enduring, patient, selfless way that Paul talks about. And John tells us not to love in words, but in action and truth. And our skills at loving, if we are in any kinds of relationships or community, our skills at loving are constantly put to the test. Peter must have been aware of this challenge because he told the church, love each other deeply because love covers over a multitude of sins. And he knew firsthand how many sins love could actually cover, I think. This kind of loving people is not something that I particularly am energized for all the time or capable of. So the good news is that we have a blueprint for love. We still have the incarnation, the introduction of the secret impossible plan. Back to Linford Detweiler, he continued, the baby born in a barn grows up and argues that we should love everybody, including ourselves, our neighbors, and yes, even our enemies. And the ensuing pain will work on us in the same manner that a sculptor's chisel works on marble. Participating in that love will cost us, refine us, demand of us. It will beautify us. It will compel us. Love will do its work on us. Again, Manning, he said, when the crucified one says, I'm dying to be with you, and then whispers, will you die a little to be with me too? My sluggish spirit is stirred, unfortunately not always, to prefer the pleasure of his company to whatever trinket of creation is mesmerizing me at the moment. If I personally, Brittany, knew how much I was loved, if I dwelled in it, I might have to abandon myself, my own needs, the distractions, my needs for self-preservation and protective boundaries, my introversion, in exchange for complete trust in a life-sustaining, life-protecting, life-giving love of the Father. I shared a lot of these thoughts with my brother, and he said that this story kind of fits in here. And I will end with this. It's from C.S. Lewis' book, The Silver Chair. A young girl comes to get a drink, and Aslan, the lion, is there. The lion says, are you not thirsty? I'm dying of thirst, said Jill. Then drink, said the lion. Would you mind going away while I do, said Jill. The lion answered this only by a look and a very low growl. And as Jill gazed at his motionless bulk, she realized that she might as well have asked the whole mountain to move for her own convenience. The delicious rippling noise of the stream was driving her nearly frantic. Will you promise not to do anything to me if I come, said Jill. I make no promise, said the lion. Jill was so thirsty now that without noticing it, she had come a step nearer. Do you eat girls, she said. I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms, said the lion. It didn't say this as if it were boasting, nor as if it were sorry, nor as if it were angry. It just said it. I daren't come and drink, said Jill. Then you will die of thirst, said the lion. Oh dear, said Jill, coming another step forward. I suppose I must go look for another stream then. There is no other stream, said the lion. Coming close to the Father might consume us. Something terrible, terribly beautiful might happen to us when we are filled up, when our thirst is quenched and we are satisfied with the water of life. The compelling, challenging, heartbreaking work of taking the abstract, I am loved, to the practical, loving others, might utterly shake us out of our boots, but there's no other way. But for today, let's rest here. I don't know your stories or your situations. I don't know how love has been handled or damaged or given or broken in your lives. But I hope there's always room, I know there is always room, for the words to penetrate that we are loved. And I know that so often we are deeply needy and deeply thirsty. Even now, as I share these thoughts, I'm in a place deeply needy, deeply thirsty. And They are only short testimonies of times, short times when my sluggish spirit has been stirred, as Brandon Manning said, stirred towards pleasure of his company. But can we join together in accepting the invitation of Paul's prayer? Can we enter it in creative ways, in journals, in songs, in friendships? Can we know together how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ? And after all of these ramblings, can we leave today with the truth that we started with, that everything starts with, and let it wash over us? We are loved. We are loved. We are loved.
I don't know if I can even say anything after that. It was beautiful. Thank you for letting us enter into his love. And so many parts of that just made me pause and made my heart beat fast and made me just feel his love. So, Brittany, thank you for helping us experience that this morning. I hope you all were moved. I can't imagine. I hope you were. I know I was. And what really strikes me is his identity is love, and our identity then is the loved. We are the loved ones. We get to experience that love. We get to be in his arms that are spread wide with love. And it's not by anything you can and cannot do. He will not stop filling you with that love. His source will continue to be there. Just like that picture of the chalice and the fountain, we don't know where that source always comes from, but it's there. Whether you can feel it or not, sometimes he is constantly filling you, desires to fill you, and it's just beautiful. And he says, come. He says, come and experience this love. So let's go from here, and let's know that you are loved. I don't know, like she said, we don't know where you come from or what your story is, but may you start a new journey in that love today if you need to. May you be refreshed in that love today if you need to. And if you don't know that love, if you don't know that source, and you want to experience that love of Jesus, talk to one of us. Talk to Brittany, myself, anyone here, Lyndall, I know he would be a great source. Stan, if you don't know that source of Jesus, find us. We would love to pray with you and help Jesus fill you with that love that is so amazing. So let's stand. Let's sing this song called Your Love is Extravagant. My favorite line is spread wide in the arms of Christ. And just envision yourself in those arms of love that enfold you, that want you. He is love.